Jeffrey Epstein's apparent jail cell suicide puts a spotlight on the rising rates of suicides in U.S. jails.
The sentence that you'll hear occasionally is, look, if a guy wants to kill himself, he's going to kill himself. And it just isn't true.
An inmate can take his or her life within a few minutes.
Today on The Takeaway for August 12th, what should be done to protect inmates in our criminal justice system? I'm Tanzina Vega. Also on the show, there is a significant racial disparity in breastfeeding with its roots in our history.
This disparity has existed from slavery. And there have always been structural reasons for this that have nothing to do with choice.
It's created a cultural disconnect from us feeding how we feed our children today.
All right, let's get moving on this Monday.
You're just thrown into a world that you don't understand, and you don't know how to, you're screaming on the inside, and you don't know how to let it come out.
We begin today with the stories of women who came forward with accusations against child predator Jeffrey Epstein. Over the weekend, Epstein was found dead in his cell at the Federal Metropolitan Correctional Center in New York in an apparent suicide.
I was always angry. After that happened, I can remember punching holes in walls. There were some times where I would just like slam my head onto something.
What I thought was so little to my life has affected me so much.
And you just become this numb figure.
Virginia Roberts Geoffrey, Michelle Licata, and Jenna Lisa Jones. Three women who say Jeffrey Epstein sexually assaulted them and arranged for other men to assault them when they were just teenagers. They're speaking there to the Miami Herald for the Perversion of Justice series from reporter Julie K. Brown that helped bring the Epstein case back into the public eye. The person behind the camera for that series?
My name is Emily Michaud. I'm a visual journalist with the Miami Herald. I think I'm still, like a lot of people, stunned by the news that Epstein died by suicide. It's taken a little time to digest and to come to terms with it.
After years of sweetheart deals with law enforcement and an uncanny ability to evade justice, Epstein was being held in a federal jail in Manhattan where he faced up to 45 years in prison if convicted.
Finally, you know, after more than a decade, there was some hope that they would have a chance to confront him in court, to have this day in court that they were robbed of so many years ago. In fact, it robbed his victims once again of meeting him in court.
Justice will now look very different for the victims of Jeffrey Epstein.
This is just a sad time for them. I think it's yet another betrayal, not only by Epstein, but of the system that somehow allowed him to take his life.
Mark Fisher is senior editor for The Washington Post, and he's been following the Epstein story. Mark, glad to have you with us on the show.
It's good to be with you, Tanzina.
So there's a lot that we don't know about the circumstances surrounding Epstein's death, but can you walk us through, there appear to be multiple failures in the system of checks for such a high-profile detainee in a federal jail.
Well, there were and there weren't. I mean, on one hand, it seems outrageous that this would be allowed to happen in a federal prison. On the other hand, they seem to have followed procedure. In other words, he was put on suicide watch after a first incident a few weeks ago where he was found injured, and he stayed there for 6 or 7 days, which is pretty much standard. At that point, he had been meeting with his lawyers for 12 hours a day in some cases, and had been meeting with the doctors at the facility, and the consensus was that he was no longer a risk to himself, so he was moved into what's called a special housing unit, where there's not a suicide watch. He's supposed to have been checked on every 30 minutes, but as some of the prison guard union chiefs told our reporters, that you know, anyone can kill themselves in 30 minutes. And so that is not suicide watch. And so he was able to do what he did. It is curious that he did not have a cellmate, which he was supposed to have. But what we're told is that one cellmate had come through, been transferred to another facility, and the next cellmate simply hadn't been assigned as yet.
Mark, the criminal case is over, essentially, because Epstein is now dead. But what are we hearing from attorneys that are representing the victims, the women in this case? What are they seeking at this point?
Well, they want to pursue this case, and there are avenues to do that. And the U.S. attorney in New York, Jeff Berman, said over the weekend that the case is not dead. Obviously, the case against Epstein is finished because he's no longer here. But they had been looking at a whole nexus of co-conspirators, people who had enabled Epstein, who had recruited the women, who had paid the women. And so those people are susceptible to prosecution. And that's what the attorneys for a number of the abuse victims want. But that is going to be a messy, long, and convoluted process. No one really knows where Epstein's resources are. No one's really quite certain how much he had. He told the court a few weeks ago that he had $559 million worth of assets. Some people believe it was much more than that. Others think it was much less than that. But what I was told by a former business partner of Epstein was that the money is well hidden overseas, and it's not clear who will be in charge of that estate.
So, Mark, we know that there is someone in charge of the estate, assuming there is an executor for the estate. I'm wondering, what about the question of restitution at this point? Is that not even on the table right now? Because it's still unclear how much he has in assets.
Well, a number of the women who were abused by Epstein are going to seek restitution through civil lawsuits. Some of those are ongoing. Some of those probably are yet to be filed. But how they get that money, whether they get that money, really uncertain, because they have to get in line with other people. There are 200,000 Americans, retirees, elderly people who lost their life savings to a financial scam that Jeffrey Epstein was a crucial part of, and they want to get in line for that money as well. So this is going to be a very difficult process, and it's not clear who will take primacy as far as getting any of those assets if they're ever distributed.
Mark, we know that Epstein's death came right after a big document dump. What do we know about what those papers said?
Well, they were interesting. They came out on Friday. It's about 2,000 pages from a case that's already been settled. The first voice you had on the air today about from Virginia Roberts Jeffrey. She was probably the most outspoken of Epstein's abused women. And in her case, although it was settled, there were all these documents that named prominent people, politicians, business leaders, and so on, who allegedly were taking part with Epstein in the abuse of girls. And there wasn't a lot of new detail there, but it was interesting to go through and see just how extensive this network was, and the whole process of recruiting and paying and sort of keeping quiet the girls who he was abusing. It is laid out in detail in a number of these documents.
Mark Fisher is senior editor for The Washington Post. Mark, great to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
According to the latest available data from the Justice Department in 2014, the suicide rate in United States jails was at its highest point in at least 14 years. That 2014 rate was more than three times higher than the suicide rate for the general population in the United States. I have two guests with me now who have looked closely at what can be done to prevent suicides in jails. Cameron Lindsay is a retired federal prison warden who now works as an expert witness in the field of corrections. Cameron, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Good to be here.
And Margo Schlanger is a professor of law at the University of Michigan, focusing on prisoner civil rights. Margo, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Margo, let's start with you. We know that there are differences in the suicide rate in prisons and in jails. So let's start with jails. Why is it so high?
Well, jails are about 70% pretrial. 30% of folks who are in jails are post-conviction, usually on more minor offenses. But compared to prisons, jails are the place where people go when they're having very serious shocks to their lives. Very seriously bad things are just now happening to them. So situationally, it's a much more dangerous time. In addition, people are much more likely to have current drug and alcohol issues. Jails are much more chaotic and tend to be less well run than prisons. And finally, jail officials know a lot less about the inmates than prison officials do, because jails are so much more short term. They're churning population.
So, Cameron, you've worked as a warden in three prisons and two jails over the course of your career. So when an inmate is brought into a facility, what did officers look for to assess their risk of suicide?
Well, they perform an intake every time any inmate comes into a correctional facility. Frankly, I think it could be a little more extensive at times. Our jails and prisons are in serious need of change. I personally believe our entire criminal justice components need to be evaluated, the police, the courts, the corrections. But yes, when inmates come into the system, they are evaluated, but frankly, it's typically cursory, and they're going through arguably the most traumatic incident in their entire lives, being incarcerated straight off the streets. That's when people are most vulnerable for suicide in jails. I completely agree with everything that the professor mentioned.
What's the determination to put someone on suicide watch at that point?
Well, an inmate can be placed on suicide watch for a multitude of reasons. It might be a self-report of depression. It might be a staff observation where the inmate's in a corner crying. I mean, it could be a number of things, but the decision to actually put an inmate on suicide watch, at least in the federal system, is made by the chief psychologist of the facility, who's also the suicide prevention program coordinator. Anytime an inmate is put on suicide watch or the decision is made to remove them from suicide watch, again, it's the decision of the chief psychologist, but it must be with the concurrence of the warden.
Margo, based off of what Cameron just said, how often is it that an inmate could fall through the cracks?
Well, I think it happens fairly often that inmates are not put on suicide watch. I think the key, though, is to remember that it's not an all or nothing kind of a decision. A good system ought to have at least two levels of supervision for people who are at elevated risk of suicide, a level of close observation and then a level of constant observation. Constant observation 24/7 is onerous both for the facility and, frankly, for the inmate. And it's expensive and it's intrusive. It's reserved for people who are, you know, actively suicidal or close to it. But there's a level below that of close observation where people ought to be under staggered kinds of checks and ought to be in suicide-resistant cells, even if they're not in constant observation. It happens very, very often that systems don't have the setup for close observation that they need for people who are at an elevated risk of suicide, but not actively suicidal. There needs to be training both on just the basic idea that suicide prevention is part of a correctional officer's job and that it can succeed. There's a real attitudinal problem. The sentence that you'll hear occasionally is, look, if a guy wants to kill himself, he's going to kill himself. And it just isn't true. Suicides can be prevented in jail, and people need training to understand that actually suicide prevention can be very successful.
Cameron, it's a difficult question to ask, and we don't have to get into the details on how something like this is carried out, but it doesn't feel easy or simple to be able to take your life when you're in prison or jail. I mean, you're being monitored all the time. There are cameras everywhere. So the question is, how hard is it?
It's not. It's simple. An inmate can kill him or herself within minutes. So many folks think that somebody has to be hanging from a ceiling or there has to be some protuberance from the ceiling where someone can tie off to and asphyxiate themselves. It's much simpler than that. Inmates can kill themselves with a T-shirt, a sheet, a pair of underwear, and they can tie off to the bunk bed and just lean forward on their knees until they pass out and then eventually asphyxiate. Staff can't monitor inmates the entire time. I mean, inmates are required to be checked on once every half hour in a special housing unit.
You mentioned special housing units, and we know that Jeffrey Epstein, for example, was in the Metropolitan Correctional Facility here in Manhattan. What are conditions like in these sections of a facility like that?
Yeah, so once Epstein was pulled off suicide watch, he would have been removed from his health services specially designed suicide prevention cell and moved back into the special housing unit. As I said, he would not be under direct and constant supervision. And from my perspective, you don't take a chance with somebody like this. You take the conservative, safe route. If you keep them on suicide watch until they leave the facility, it wouldn't have been indefinite. He was a pretrial, pre-sentence inmate. It would have been a matter of not too long a time before his case was adjudicated and the Bureau could have designated him to the facility to serve his sentence.
Margo, in terms of determining whether someone is a suicide risk, we know that often the folks are placed in isolation, and alternatively, folks may be given an inmate, a roommate, or a cellmate, should I say, in something that's called the buddy system. Do we know whether either of those has a positive or negative impact on one's ability or likelihood of committing suicide?
As I said, you really don't want this to be an all or nothing determination. And what it sounds like is that that's the way it was treated here. So even if somebody is on 24/7 constant observation, there are a number of systems that provide some of that observation by way of another inmate, usually not a cellmate, usually outside the room, but it's an inmate doing the watching. That's best used as a supplement, but it has been shown to be quite effective. But even if somebody's not on constant observation, there's a huge risk factor for suicide of isolation. And so if somebody is at an elevated risk of suicide, you don't want them in solitary confinement if you can possibly avoid it. And also you don't want them on half-hour checks that are at even half hours. You want them on staggered checks every 10 or 15 minutes, but no more than every 10 or 15 minutes. And you want them in a suicide-resistant cell, even if they're not on 24/7 constant observation. As Cameron said, a regular bed poses a very significant risk of facilitating suicide. But it's not rocket science to make a bed that doesn't have a way that you can hang yourself from it. It's not that complicated. And you can make suicide-resistant cells that are in special housing units so that people can be housed in special housing units longer term and not have these easy avenues to kill themselves.
Cameron, I want to bring you back in here because I don't want to sound conspiratorial here, but I wonder if, given the lack of federal oversight for a lot of state and county jails and facilities, I think of the case like Sandra Bland, who was pulled over by police and then just didn't make it out of the cell, and she was said to have died by suicide in the cell. How do we know, Cameron, how does the public know that these are in fact suicides, that these are not altercations with COs, that they aren't illnesses gone awry or untreated? How does the public know that in fact these numbers are accurate?
Well, they don't. And sometimes it's proven to be that they are in fact accurate. So, you know, there's just so much work that needs to be done with our systems of justice. You know, there really is no single criminal justice system. We have a compilation of police, courts, and corrections at the local, state, and federal levels. They're kind of all doing their own thing. There really is no particular system, but it's just super important to realize, I believe, that we need reform in our systems to include corrections, certainly, and I certainly recognize that.
Margo, what specific policy reforms do you see that could help decrease the jail suicide rate?
I think for decades, the Justice Department itself has sued city and county jails and settled those lawsuits by implementing a set of pretty simple reforms that deal with identification and assessment and observation, housing, mental health treatment, emergency response, and training. There's not a one step that solves the problem, but it's not rocket science. It's a protocol that addresses jail suicide, that addresses those six factors, and it works. And so what has to happen is that jails have to take that stuff seriously and implement it, and that includes the federal jails.
Cameron Lindsay is a retired federal prison warden and the author of Triple Deuces, A Day in the Life of an American Correctional Worker. And Margo Schlanger is a professor of law at the University of Michigan. Thanks to you both.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
You've been telling us about your experiences with breastfeeding.
I breastfed. It took a bit of adjustment and diet changes to make it work for the both of us.
I breastfed because that's what my mother said to do.
It felt natural and helped us bond.
It was private and special bonding time for us, and it was easy and inexpensive too.
I breastfed my daughter for the antibody benefits, but the pain was excruciating.
I never breastfed my kids. For me, I found it to be just gross. And that's just my opinion.
I was hauling around a pump, ice pack, and pumping in supply closets and even in a public park during the winter at one point.
My daughter was an enthusiastic eater. I was convinced her first words would be, ouch.
Kudos to all the moms that did it or still doing it. I think you're amazing for doing it. But for me, I just wasn't comfortable with it.
I breastfed my babies, but I do not take to shaming mothers who don't want to breastfeed or can't breastfeed. The last thing that a new mother needs, all the other stress of having a baby, is to be shamed because she doesn't or can't breastfeed.
In 2011, the United States Breastfeeding Committee declared August National Breastfeeding Month as a way to promote and support breastfeeding. But the decision to breastfeed and access to resources around it can vary a lot depending on your race. Black Breastfeeding Week, which falls at the end of this month, was started by Black women to acknowledge the many specific challenges that Black families face when it comes to breastfeeding. In fact, in the United States alone, white educated women are more likely to breastfeed and for longer periods for reasons that are deeply rooted in our nation's history. And I have two people here with me to talk about the racial disparities in breastfeeding and how it can become more accessible to all of us. Kimberly Seals-Allers is a journalist, a strategist for maternal and infant health, and author of The Big Letdown: How Medicine, Big Business, and Feminism Undermine Breastfeeding. Kimberly, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
And Andrea Freeman is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Hawaii and author of Skimmed: Breastfeeding, Race, and Injustice. Andrea, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
So, Kimberly, let's start with you. We hear a lot about breast is best when it comes to breastfeeding. Can you remind us what we actually know about the differences in what does it make a difference in how a baby is fed, whether it's formula or breast milk?
Well, we do know that breast milk is an unparalleled source of infant nutrition. And, you know, just our bodies, this is how our, you know, our species has survived for generation by generation by generations. And so I think that the scientific evidence, the body of evidence overwhelmingly proves that breast milk is superior. I think that we intuitively know that something that's being made in a factory can never replicate something that's kind of moving and changing. I mean, breast milk changes according to your body's needs and your infant's needs and what you ate. And it's a real kind of relationship-driven type of fluid. And so I don't, you know, the issue has really not about whether breast milk is better than infant formula, because infant formula has never been proven to be superior to breast milk. The issue is, to your point, can we make it accessible? Because having something great that women can't offer to their babies is really not the end game for anyone. So, you know, yes, the scientific evidence is clear over time, and formula has never been proven to be superior to breast milk in any way. But how do we take that information and now make it something that's actually accessible?
So let's talk, Kimberly, a little bit about the racial divide in breastfeeding. Mm-hmm. What does the data tell us?
So the data tells us that racial disparities have lingered for over 40 years. Pretty much as long as they've been capturing the data, there's been a disparity. So that means that so many fewer of Black infants are receiving that optimal standard of nutrition. And that's something that should concern us all. The other thing that is really important to consider is that in this country, what we're learning about Black women and their birth outcomes is very much connected to breastfeeding, because Black women disproportionately give birth to babies who are too small, too sick, or they give birth too soon, right? Our rates for preterm birth, twice as likely than white women, low birth weight babies. So because of how Black women actually give birth, and this is also regardless of socioeconomics, education, those babies need breast milk more. So while we often have a conversation about lifestyle and quote-unquote choice, we can talk about that, but for Black women whose babies are disproportionately being born too small, too sick, and too soon, they need breast milk more, those babies. And so we see that that is also connected to the Black infant mortality rate. And so we really can't have the same simplistic breast is best, it's a choice conversation when we're talking, and particularly about Black women, because there's so much more at stake.
So, Andrea, I want to bring you in here, because when we started here on the show talking about this issue, I immediately started thinking about access and, you know, when you can breastfeed and where you can breastfeed and how women can breastfeed. And you've studied Black women in particular and how they have different rates of breastfeeding than white women. Tell us about some of your findings.
Okay, thank you. I would also add that this disparity has existed from slavery, and there have always been structural reasons for this that have, as she said, nothing to do with choice. So we can look at things like the United States government being the biggest purchaser of formula in the United States and then giving it out free to people who receive WIC, that's for women and children, disproportionately Black women. We can see the welfare shift forcing women to leave the home when they have infants, and that makes it impossible for them to breastfeed. We have a lack of restrictions on formula marketing in the United States, whereas every other country has agreed to sign on to this World Health Organization code. The United States has not because of its close relationship with the formula industry. We have marketing that happens through hospitals and pediatricians that doesn't even look like marketing. And we have very weak laws that would protect women who want to pump at work to keep breastfeeding. We have a lack of parental leave from work. Basically, I could go on and on with all of these structural factors that have nothing to do with whether a woman wants to breastfeed or not.
Well, Andrea, when I think about that, I think about, the ability, for example, like you said, to be able to pump at work. I think you need an accommodation to do that. You need the time to do that. You need a place to put what you've pumped, right, in the meantime. I'm thinking about women who are making minimum wage jobs, who are working shift work, for example, who don't have the ability to do that. How does that impact the ability to breastfeed?
Oh, very much so. And the other thing you need is you need to be paid for those breaks. So sometimes you might find a little bit of accommodation because the law requires it, but it's actually not enough to make it possible, right? So maybe you can take the time, but if you can't afford to take the time, then that's the same thing as not being able to take it.
And Kimberly, we were talking earlier about how the disparity in breastfeeding between Black women and white women has its roots in slavery. And I'm wondering, how has that history impacted how Black women think about breastfeeding today?
Yes. Yeah, so in my work on the ground and my strategy work, working many, in communities across the Southeast, Detroit, Philadelphia, particularly in matriarchal societies, what I've observed is like this idea that breastfeeding is something that we did for other people, something that we didn't do for ourselves, something we were forced to do, something that reminds us of a time that we're trying to forget, has been passed on generationally, often without a word. And so many older relatives who are very influential to mothers, many of the grandmothers and aunties who raised us may now become a source of childcare, and they have no idea about how to care for a breastfed baby. They don't know how to handle breast milk, and do you shake it? Can you microwave it, et cetera, et cetera. And so because of that disconnect, it's created a cultural disconnect from us feeding how we feed our children today. And so we see, I was a first generation breastfeeder, but we see this idea that you're pretty much a pioneer in your family trying to break down, walls and barriers and educating. And it's a lot. It's a lot. And so we do see that has lingered. Certainly, we think about the WIC influence, this idea that something is government endorsed, quote unquote. Well, it must be good. And it also must be noted that many times WIC does not give enough for the whole month, and that women at the end of the month are either forced to stretch the formula, which obviously compromises its nutritional quality, or they're forced to go pay that shelf price, which is now inflated because of all the subsidies that the infant formula companies give to the government and to the hospitals. And so it's a setup all the way around.
So Andrea, I want to bring you back in here because I want to talk a little bit about, again, similar to what we were just saying with Kimberly, how does this play out today when it comes to racial disparities? I know I had just having a conversation with a woman of color yesterday who was talking about her struggles to breastfeed. She said when she was in the hospital, they focused a lot on breastfeeding. She felt guilty because it just wasn't working for her. And she ended up going back to the hospital and begging the doctor to just please give me formula because it's not working. She's a Black woman. She's a Black woman of Latina descent. So I'm wondering, do these issues play out today, Andrea, when it comes to racial disparities and maybe even shaming of women who are unable to breastfeed?
Absolutely. And one of the layovers or legacies that we have from slavery is also stereotypes. And in slavery, there was developed the idea of the bad black mother. And that was used then to justify separating women from their infants, from their children, blaming black women for their desire to care, the supposed desire to care for white infants and white children and neglect of their own. And we've seen that go throughout history and continues into the present. And it justifies even now the idea that hospitals and doctors don't give as much attention to black women in the hospital. They don't provide the lactation resources. Communities do not have these resources. Kimberly knows a lot about this. She's talked about first food deserts. I talk in my book about first food swamps and the way that people are inundated with formula and assumptions that underlie the treatment that people receive based on their race.
Mm-hmm. And these disparities in care are really important to look at. If you look at historically, who has been kind of the marquee brand for breastfeeding support? It was La Leche League, right? A very powerful, important woman-led organization. However, La Leche League was white women, not even working white women, right? So there's been this disparity of support. And hospitals, yes, are ground zero, but a hospital for a woman in this country is only 2 or 3 days. So if she leaves the hospital, which she may have had a lactation consultant, and then goes back to her community and it's, you know, a virtual quote unquote desert of support, then she's in a setup for failure. The other thing that we have to look at is this biological connection between stress and your ability to lactate. And what the studies show is that stress will literally limit your letdown reflux, which is that thing that your body does to release your milk. And if we aren't talking about social stressors,
And let's be honest, yeah. I mean, social stressors for women of color in particular,
exactly.
Black and brown women are severe.
And
not to suggest that white women don't face social stresses, but we have additional stresses that are economic, that are social, and on
cultural,
and on. And so, right, cultural, exactly.
Things that we deal with day to day, microaggressions, you know, in our work life and things like that. And so if we're looking at stressed out women and then wondering why they are not breastfeeding for any meaningful duration, well, the answer is very clear. And so we really have to help people understand that relationship within their bodies and how do we kind of address that, create an outlet for that, and while we actually deal with this disparity of support to make sure that in our communities, there are places for us to go. And that is changing. And so we really have to amplify those resources that are available to black women from other black women in their communities.
Andrea, what about breastfeeding, perceptions of breastfeeding in public? I mean, I'm starting to see more places where women can breastfeed. In airports, for example, there are little cabanas or cubicles set up mm-hmm. so women can go in and breastfeed. But we also know that this is something that's very contentious and for better or worse. And often it's white women, I think, that are allowed to do this perhaps more than women of color. Are women of color and black women in particular shamed when they try to breastfeed in public?
Yes, absolutely. And this goes back again to the history of this country and where black women can feel comfortable and not comfortable. So even if theoretically you are protected, you are able to breastfeed, that doesn't account for the pushback that you're going to get from other people, mostly white women and other people who just don't feel like you belong in that space or you should be there breastfeeding. So I think in this very particular case, law can't do much to protect against the kind of vigilante culture that we have around this.
And also, we have to look at the history of black women's bodies. I mean, we can't ignore the body politics. Like, black and brown women's bodies have always been more controversial, more provocative, hypersexualized, you know, over time. And so we can't ignore what our bodies mean in the historical context as well. So that is why I believe when a black woman is breastfeeding, it is such a revolutionary act because of we are defying all the stories that have been told about our bodies. And we are doing something that, you know, perhaps even white women don't want us to do. And this idea that we are bringing attention to our bodies is something that other people would love to say when we're simply trying to feed our children.
Want to close out here, Andrea. Any final thoughts on what can be done, whether it's law or otherwise, to help mm-hmm. make this a better experience for women of all races?
I think it's really important to remember that all of these laws and policies that make it difficult for Black women to breastfeed come from a close partnership between the formula industry and the government, something we saw last year when we saw the U.S. government threatening Ecuador for trying to put forth a resolution in the World Health Assembly to promote breastfeeding. And we see that the government is basically in bed with the formula industry. And for that reason, it's very hard to change any kinds of law or policy. So the work that Kimberly is doing and others that is grassroots is so important because we can't rely on the government, which is under a regulatory capture, to actually do anything.
Andrea Freeman is Associate Professor of Law at the University of Hawaii and author of Skimmed, Breastfeeding, Race, and Injustice. And Kimberly Seals-Allers is a journalist, a strategist for maternal and infant health, and author of The Big Letdown, How Medicine, Big Business, and Feminism Undermine Breastfeeding. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.